The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas B. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas B. Gibbs is on the air.
All right, good evening. Welcome to Mr. Constitution Hour here on Cape Wraith, KPRZ. I'm glad you're here. My name is Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution, douglasvgibbs.com, mrconstitution.com. And we have been working our way through the Constitution along with a few other things. So let's get the Bible and the Constitution working together here. And we are on the 16th Amendment. The 16th Amendment, which was ratified in 1913 along with the Federal Reserve Act, and the 17th Amendment makes it probably the most unconstitutional year in the history of the Constitution in the sense of amendments and acts that joined in with those amendments. The ruling elite of the world decided they wanted us to move closer to a global system. We needed to be on a, from their point of view, a centralized banking system, which we had abandoned back in 1836. And in order to pay a debt-based system, you got to pay, whenever you have debt-based, and that means you have a central bank that you're borrowing money from, which drives up national debts. Also, in order to pay that, you also have interest that you have to pay. And with that interest, you need increased revenue. So the idea was that they would begin to tax the people directly. Problem is, in Article 1, Section 9 of the United States Constitution, it says you can't tax the people directly. The states were paying the income tax. And the states, by paying the income tax, were looking at the budget and saying, we're not paying for anything unconstitutional. Take that out or we don't give you our money. And so it limited the ability of the federal government to centralize and act in an unconstitutional manner. So they needed to get rid of that. So the 16th Amendment, which also originally was not ratified properly, they even had a couple of the states even broke their own rules in order to ratify it because the political class, the progressive class, was so adamant about getting the 16th Amendment passed. And the 16th Amendment reads, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes and whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. And when it comes to money, remember the Bible, it doesn't say that money is the root of all evil. It says the love of money is the root of all evil. If money becomes your idol, if money becomes your god, then it's evil. It's not evil to do well. It's not evil to be wealthy. It's not evil to be rich. However, if you are rich, you tend to make money that idol, and that's where the love of money is the root of all evil, and the love of money is the problem. And you also have the, in the Bible where it talks about the, it's easier for a camel to thread through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get into heaven. That eye of the needle was the entrance into the city where it was only wide enough and big enough for the camel to get through. In order for the camel to get through that eye of the needle, everything had to be stripped from it. In other words, you have to lose all of everything in order to get through it, that camel to get through it. You have to lose all the baggage, all of the riches, everything on that camel set. Only the camel goes through the eye of the needle. The rich man is not willing to shed those things in order to get into heaven. That's the reason why it's easier for the camel to get through the eye of the needle, because the rich man will not shed the things that need to be shed in order to become a follower of Christ. Or at least that's what was said. But it goes even deeper than this. When it comes to money, people, talk about, well, Jesus, when he, got involved in politics, right? And he threw the money changers off of the steps at the temple. Also, there's the where the Pharisees tried to trap Jesus when it talked about the tax and the money and all sort of stuff. And Jesus answered, well, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him. Why did they marvel at him? Because he really put them in a tough situation. He was actually accusing them of something. Most people, when they hear this verse, they say, well, the money had Caesar's face on it. So what he's saying is pay your tax, but, everything else goes to God or tithing goes to God. No. The tithing was being used with Caesar's money, but if you go to Haggai chapter 2, verse 8 in the Old Testament, it says, "The silver and gold belong to me, saith Jehovah of hosts." So the silver and gold belongs to God, but the silver and gold has Caesar's face on it. So the silver and gold has been defaced. It has been turned into an idol. And the temple priests are operating using this money and, well, craving this money and wanting as much of this money to come in. But it is an evil thing because it is an idol with Caesar's face on it. Caesar put his face on the gold and silver that belongs to God. And they marveled at him because he was basically saying, hey, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and give unto God what is God's, and what is God's is gold and silver, even though Caesar's face is on it. He was basically telling them that they were acting against the law, against the Old Testament law, against Haggai 2:8, and that's why they marveled at him. And so we've got this situation where money is mentioned in the Bible multiple times. These are just a few of the places in which it is. So once again, there's nothing wrong with doing well. You know, it's like I joke around when people talk about the 1%, and I say, well, you know, I don't want to get rid of the 1%. I want to be part of the 1%. That's kind of been my joke. You know, there's nothing wrong with doing well. But you know, when you do well, when money becomes something that is readily available to you because you are wealthy or whatnot, you have to make sure that Jesus Christ still comes first. Money is a secondary thing. It cannot become your idol. It cannot become your God. It cannot supersede your faith. Your faith in Jesus Christ has to come first. So that's, now we got the 16th Amendment. We've got people who are craving power and wealth and so on and so forth that are behind the 16th Amendment. And what it does is it changes our system from people not being allowed to be directly taxed by the Constitution to them being directly taxed. And this is another, and there's something else that's key when it comes to the 16th Amendment. What's happening here now is, remember, now let's go all the way back to the Constitutional Convention. And we've got the United States Constitution being written. The states sent their delegates to the Constitutional Convention, 1787, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, during that summer, that hot summer of 1787, and they are representing their states. We the people of the United States. So it is we the people, but of the United States, representing the states. The states are a voice here too. The states, through their delegates, and the fact that they're giving up their powers, some of their powers. So remember, states had original authority. They had all of the powers prior to the Constitution. They're giving up some of their powers to this federal government so it can function to handle external issues that are directly related to the union, and so forth. So, if they are going to do this, the states are creating a contract on the Constitution, the states are a party to that contract. But in making this federal government, the states put the mechanisms in place for them to be, so that they can be have oversight over it. So, in the beginning, there was nothing the federal government could do without the permission of the state legislatures. This mechanism through the taxation was one of those mechanisms. The federal government could not spend, no federal spending was allowed, without approval by the states through the taxation process, in which the states are the ones that paid the budget. The budget went to the states. The states said, hey, we're not paying for that. Try again, that kind of thing. So the 16th Amendment pulls that away from the states. That oversight over the federal government goes away. Another move away from being a republic towards being a democracy. And remember, democracies are dangerous. We're not a democracy, or at least we're not supposed to be one. We're becoming one. We are almost a complete democracy because of what they've been doing to our system. The recipe is being monkeyed with and it's messed up. We're supposed to be a republic, and part of being a republic are these mechanisms that limit the power of the vote of the people. The vote of the people is a good thing to a point, but any power given in too much of an amount to anything can be dangerous. Democracy is the same. If we have too much power, we will mess it up too. And that's, you know, you go back to, once again, John Adams, there's never been a democracy that didn't commit suicide. James Madison, democracies are short in their lives and violent in their deaths. And of course, Thomas Jefferson, a democracy is tyranny of the majority in which 51% can vote away the rights of the other 49%. And so the democracy is in play here. The Republic is being compromised. 16th Amendment allows federal government now to directly tax the people. Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes. The word income is not defined, that I've found anyway, and I've got a couple copies, in the IRS code. Why? Because they want it to mean whatever they want. Income is something that increases in value. So income is something like dividends, you know, interest that you make on your savings accounts, things like that. Income might be capital gains. You have a property or something that was worth something at one point and it is increased in value. When I say property, I don't just mean real estate. You might have a vase that was worth such and such at one point when you inherited it or you bought it, and now it's worth so much. Now it's more. That there's an appreciation of value there. That's income. But your wages, what you receive, your paycheck, technically, when it comes to the original definitions, that's not income. You are trading your time and labor for money. So it is a type of barter. It is not income. But they want to make sure they can call that income too. So income is not defined in the IRS code. And then here in the 16th Amendment, the Congress have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived. By adding from whatever source derived, that means any money that comes in, anything that comes to you, is considered income. Except for maybe a gift. That's about it. And so, and then it says, without apportionment among the several states. What that means, and without regard to any census or enumeration, what that means is, remember, the states paid the taxes before, and how they paid their taxes was based on the census, was based on the apportionment among the states due to the census or and enumeration of you know, how many citizens you have. And so therefore, like, for example, right now, California has 11.9% of the total population of the country, roughly 12%. So if we were on the old method, California would pay 12% of the overall taxes due. Now, that doesn't matter anymore. It's not based on the state. It's not based on population. It's based on you as the individual. Now, you as the individual, if you don't pay your taxes, now we have an IRS, which was created in 1862, by the way, during the Lincoln presidency, which has a whole different conversation written all over it that we'll talk about some other time. So now we have this ungodly, wealth-driven, power-driven amendment that violates everything the Founding Fathers had originally put into place. Remember Article 1, Section 9, and I mentioned this earlier. Let's read it real quick just so that you understand what they're violating here. Article 1, Section 9, it says that no capitation will be a head tax, an individual tax, a per-person tax. No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census and enumeration herein before directed to be taken. Herein therefore directed to be taken. Earlier in Article 1, Section 2, it says, hey, there's an apportionment. The 14th Amendment alters that apportionment a little bit because the three-fifths clause is removed. But basically, they figure out the census. Free people, slaves, do not count non-citizens. That's the apportionment. That determines how many members of the House of Representatives a state has, but also determined how much taxes the state would pay when it came to the federal budget. The federal budget went to the states, not to the people, and the states looked at it and then would pay their percentage once they were happy with it. Now there's no approval process. Now the federal government says, this is our budget and you're paying it. You don't pay it, you're arrested. Period. No debate. No due process, pay it or else. Because we said we need to spend this money. It used to be the states would say, no, it's unconstitutional. You're not going to spend that money. We're not going to give you the money. 16th Amendment changed all that. So we have a situation now where we're moving away from being a republic towards a democracy with the 16th Amendment. And we're doing it because the powers of the time, the ruling elite, they want to get more power. They want a centralized banking system. They want to also straddle the United States with massive debt. Because by having a Federal Reserve, it does a few things. Number one, it makes them rich. But number two, the big thing is they can control the economy. They can put in place inflation. You think the inflation we're experiencing now is on accident? Government says, well, we're not sure how we can control this inflation. You know, it's because of, you know, this happened and that. No, it's because of what you guys are doing. You increase the debt. You devalue the value of the currency. You're going to have inflation. Inflation is basically hidden taxation. That's all it is. So we have the 16th Amendment that creates an opportunity for the federal government to have this Federal Reserve and to pay the interest, which they can't even pay anymore because it's so high, because the debt's so high, which allows them to control the economic activities of this country, control the value of the currency, control the value of manufacturing and consumerism, to control all of that. In fact, I'm a firm believer that despite the argument to the contrary, which says that Smoot-Hawley caused the Great Depression, that was an act that put in place some big tariffs, and that's the reason why the Democrats are freaking out when Trump was talking tariffs, because they're going back to Smoot-Hawley, because, oh, well, that caused the Great Depression, so tariffs are bad. No, tariffs can be good, if done properly, but like anything, in moderation. You don't do too much, it's bad. You don't do too little, it's bad. They would rather do too little, in other words, none, because they want to all just be working together on a global economic type platform. So, Smoot-Hawley, it is said, started the Great Depression. I'm here to tell you, no, it's a manipulation, artificial manipulation of the currency and of the economies by the Federal Reserve and by the central banking in the world. That's what caused the Great Depression. When you have no central banking system, no artificial influences on economies, you'll see, and there's graphs out there that talk about this, a very mild up and down wave, almost like the just like the ripples of an ocean, real slight of up and down activity. Consumerism, when you don't have a central banking system, consumerism and manufacturing supply determines how the economy rises and falls. You don't really see inflation per se, as long as there's no manipulation and everybody has equal trust in the currency. The moment there starts to be a loss of faith in the currency or artificial manipulation of the currency by outside sources such as a Federal Reserve or a review board or some type of governing body, you start to see these larger ups and downs, a roller coaster, high waves of economic activity. It's a boom-bust cycle. Look it up, BOOM-BUST, boom-bust cycles, where you have these great highs and these nasty lows. We've been noticing this lately, haven't we? We had the housing bubble that then suddenly burst. We were very high and the very low. Now we're very high again in the housing market, and guess what? It's getting ready to crash again. You have these high rises and these crashes when you allow artificial manipulation of the system, artificial manipulation of the currency. And they do this, and they've been doing it more lately, and it's a control mechanism. It is a way for them to manipulate, control your money, your wealth, your hopes, your dreams. I was in an argument with It was an argument. I was in a debate with this young, new communist, and he's talking about how much he hates the 1%. And I tried to explain to him, well, we have that in common. He says, no, you love the 1%. And I said, no, I don't love the 1%. I hate the 1%. But the difference between you and I is you want to get rid of the 1%. I just want to keep them from manipulating and practicing in collusion with the government. Be rich, do well. I have no problem with that. But when you start using the power of your wealth to manipulate political systems, you're dangerous. That should not be allowed. He wants wealth not to be allowed. Get rid of all the wealthy. That'll solve the problem. But then later on, he's talking about taxation and, you know, how taxes, you know, make the roads. And I said, well, if you get rid of the 1%, who's going to pay for the taxes of the roads? He says, well, the rest of us. You do realize, I told him, that the upper echelon, the top upper 5, 10%ers, they're the ones that pay 80% of the taxes. The top 10% pays 80% of the taxes. He pulls out his phone because he thinks I'm wrong, and his investigation, even with Google, proves me correct. I said, so you like those wonderful roads that we have? Say bye-bye to them. Potholes and dirt roads and horrible infrastructure if you get rid of the 1% or the 5% or the 10%. Because they're paying most of the taxes. They're the ones that are putting those roads in. Of course, those taxes shouldn't be going directly to the federal government. They should be going to the states. States should be taking care of the roads. None of the federal government's business. The roads were much nicer before the federal government started taking control there. That's a whole different discussion for a different time. So here we are now with this situation here where we have been given a system that is more democratic and gives more power to the wealthy, the power hungry, because they wanted a Federal Reserve, which the Federal Reserve Act was approved on December 23rd of 1913, or that's when it went into play. And ever since then, you've had, remember Article 1, Section 8, Congress shall coin the money. Congress made the money. They determined the value, regulated the value thereof, it says in the Constitution. Now, Congress can't just make the money and determine the value and only put what's necessary into the system. Now, we have a Federal Reserve, as a friend of mine, Alan Meyer, says, with their replicator, and they create money with a push of a button or a pin stroke in a ledger before computers. And then, when they create that money, it's not money yet until it gets into the system, but then America borrows it to put it in the system, creating that debt. It used to be the only time debt was created is when countries borrowed from each other. When you allow the central banking to get involved, which emerged pretty much in the 1600s, there's other banking situations prior to that, but the really true, the true version of what we have today with the international independent bank, private banking, really emerged during the 1600s. And we tried to get away from that with the original 13th Amendment. I think I talked about that with you. Not the original 13th Amendment. Well, that was a part of it, but also our First Bank of the United States charter expired at the same time the original 13th Amendment was ratified. Second Bank of the United States, once again, causing all kinds of problems. Andrew Jackson, typically I don't like the guy, father of the Democratic Party, but he did do a couple things right. One of them was he got rid of the central bank, the Bank of the United States, in 1836. We operated without a central bank from 1836 to 1913 with the birth of the Federal Reserve, and we did just fine. Why do we do just fine? Because central banking allows artificial manipulation of the currency and the economic system. When there's artificial manipulation, you get your boom bust cycles, you get Great Depressions, your Great Recessions, and so on and so forth. And besides, you've got all these rich people who have money as their God, and as Jesus said, render therefore to Caesar things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him because the gold and silver belong to me. Of course, we're off of the gold and silver standard now, and silver and gold belongs to God, so maybe that's a good thing. But the thing is, because it's fiat currency, now we have other problems because it's not worth anything. The moment we stop believing in it, it's worth nothing. And they want to go to a cashless society where everything's electronic. Oh, well, let's just use our cards for everything. What happens when the lights go out? What happens when the computer goes down and the lights go out? Well, Doug, that won't happen. You sure? You don't put all your eggs in one basket. Didn't we learn that when we were children? What about the Carrington event, which happened just prior to the war between the states. It fried all of the telegraph wires throughout the United States. Carrington event was where the sun spit a giant, basically, fireball of radiation towards the Earth. It hits the Earth and it fries all the stuff. That happens. That's a worldwide EMP, my friends. Everything goes down. Everything, life stops. Suddenly your cash will be important. If you're in a cashless society, then what do? If everything with electronics in it is done, goes down, what do? And that's not even considering terrorist attacks and, you know, the fact that our massive electrical system is based on roughly, I mean, yes, there's been updates on certain parts of it, but basically it's on late 1800s technology. And here we are, with massive debt, being directly taxed, and out of control federal spending that's unconstitutional, and it all began with central banking, and then it was put on steroids by the 16th Amendment. So that's that part of it. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, 17th Amendment. A lot to talk about on the 17th Amendment. It's very important because that's another way we went from being a republic to closer to a democracy, because they monkeyed with our U.S. Senate. Why did they monkey with our U.S. Senate? We'll talk about that. Don't go anywhere. Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs. Radical, powerful, enlightening. The journey of America is a tale that needs to be heard, and Mr. Constitution tells it each week on the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, Saturdays at 9 p.m. Pacific on K-Praise, San Diego's Salem Media radio station for Christian programming, FM 106.1 in North County, AM 1210 in San Diego, and online for the world at kprz.com.
We are the socialists. You will be assimilated. Your individual liberties, personal freedoms, and mental individuality will be added to our own. Resistance is futile.
Creator by Douglas V. Gibbs is on sale now. His eighth book, A True Action Plan for Christians When It Comes to Restoring the Republic. The keystone of American liberty is the Creator. Without a godly foundation, like an arch without its keystone, our whole system comes crumbling down. Thanks to age-old ideologies and an ancient lust for power and wealth, once again, our world is upside down. Evil has become good, and good has become evil. The churches have been infiltrated, and the rule of law has been replaced by the rule of man. To restore our liberty and the virtuous nature of our country, we must understand what is happening and what to do. Creator is a book that illuminates the realities that swirl around the foundation of American liberty and addresses seven critical issues directly related to our system of liberty that we must understand, address, and fight. For if we are to reestablish our American way of life on a foundation and cornerstone based on the Founding Fathers' beliefs in our Creator, and as Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, the laws of nature and of nature's God, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. That was in the Declaration of Independence, and now our time has come upon us. Now it is our turn. How do we address what is going on? What are the true causes of the rise of tyranny in America? What steps must we take as a people to keep the republic? It all begins with our Creator. On sale now by Douglas V. Gibbs. Learn more at Amazon.com or DouglasVGibbs.com/store. Douglas V. Gibbs here, Mr. Constitution. You know, I spent 20 years in the construction industry, and now that I'm no longer in the industry, I still feel like I'm always building. But instead of building homes or doing the things that make a home larger or better, I'm doing it with the constitutional education endeavor that I'm involved in. So we are currently building and enhancing what we do. All we need is help from you. Let us know what you think of the website as it grows. Send us an email at Douglas V. Gibbs at www.douglasvgibbs.com. Or if you want to help fund our efforts, you can go to douglasvgibbs.com or politicalpistachio.com and hit the donate button and contribute to the effort. We want to make this as big as possible. We want to get the word out about the Constitution. We want it to spread to all the minds in this country so that we can turn this back around, restore our republic, restore our Constitution, and be back on the right footing. DouglasVGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com. All right, welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on KPRZ, San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. All right, welcome back. So we're in the 17th Amendment now, 16th Amendment, 17th Amendment, Federal Reserve Act. That's what we're talking about. We've talked about what the Bible has to say about money and wealth and all of that. And there's a book out there that was published way back in the 60s, and I'll give you the exact year in just a second, published in 1968. And this book was written by a gentleman by the name of Curtis B. Dahl, C-U-R-T-I-S-B-D-A-L-L, Dahl, and it's titled FDR, My Exploited Father-in-Law, An Intimate Account of the Man, the Regime, and the Legacy. This was by his son-in-law. And so Curtis writes in the book, he was an insider, and he had friends that knew what was going on, and he goes back to the time of the but we're talking about 16th Amendment, 17th Amendment, Federal Reserve, the 1913. Well, before that, here's what was going on. And this is from that book on page 137, for those of you paying attention to and making notes on what to buy and where to find it. This is a resource for you that's available. Curtis B. Dahl, FDR, My Exploited Father-in-Law, page 137. Occasionally on a Saturday morning in the summer of 1912, Bernard Baruch was one of those big name banker guys, a J.P. Morgan type, would walk into the Democratic headquarters with Woodrow Wilson in tow. Woodrow Wilson to be the next president, hopefully, from their point of view, because he was agreeable to the Federal Reserve Act and so forth. And Howard Taft, who was president, the Republican president at the time, who was very conservative when it came to the economics part of it, was dead set against the Federal Reserve and changing the Constitution in any way that would better enable the Federal Reserve. So Bernard Baruch would walk into the Democrat headquarters with Woodrow Wilson in tow, leading him like one would a poodle on a string. Wilson would be quite solemn-faced in appearance, dressed in dark, formal clothes, having just arrived in New York from Trenton. According to my friend, Wilson would be given his special indoctrination course in politics by several of the top advisors assembled there. The course consisted chiefly of outlining to him and his agreeing in principle to 1. Aiding and pushing the projected Federal Reserve Bank legislation through Congress when Paul Warburg approved the final draft of the proposed act then being worked on. 2. Aiding and changing the method of electing U.S. senators by establishing a direct vote of the people, which provided more control over the Senate by the professional politicians. 17th Amendment. 17th Amendment, this change, we were told, was to get rid of corruption. It was actually to put in place corruption. 3. Agreeing to aid and introduce the graduated personal income tax, which was brought over here from England to drain off the results of our individual initiative. It takes away initial initiative if every time you do really well, they hammer you with a progressive tax. By the way, progressive taxation is also one of the planks of the in the Communist Manifesto. 4. If called upon to lend a sympathetic ear and aid indicated policy if war should break out in Europe. They saw World War I coming long before it happened. 5. To lend a thoughtful ear to recommendations made by policy in respect of filling key cabinet posts. In other words, hey, You're president. We helped you get there. You're going to put our people into place in positions of power and around you to advise you. Wilson dutifully received and absorbed his indoctrination, shook hands all around, and then departed. Whereupon, the leaders and advisors went into the back room of headquarters, shut the door, and had a big belly laugh. Someone would then ask, "How is our other candidate doing?" The other candidate was Theodore Roosevelt, the Bull Moose leader. Progressive Party is another name for that party. Hence, the strong support of that steering committee in the 1912 election went out to both Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, who had lined up against President Taft. So, the second Republican was backed by the Democrats. It appeared that President Taft had not been very receptive and disapproved of the political desires expressed by certain pro-Zionist political leaders here in respect to U.S. relations with Russia. Thus, the Republican vote was neatly split by the insurgent Bull Moosers, and the Democratic candidate Woodrow Wilson won. So there you go. Now, when it says pro-Zionist, it's not talking about the Jewish people or Israel in particular. It's talking about those who were of a communist way of thinking that were pushing for Israeli control. Israel didn't exist yet, but Jewish control in the banking systems and all that. But what's funny is a lot of these people were also part of that Jewish pro-Zionist system. It's an interesting topic that we'll go into some other time. I hate it when people start talking about the Jew. Well, which Jew are you talking about? You talking about the bloodline Jew or the non-bloodline Jew? You talking about the pro-Zionist based on God's version of what Zionism is? Or pro-Zionism based on what the communist version of Zionism is? I'm a firm believer we need to support Israel, even though today's Israel may not necessarily be the Israel that it ought to be. America is not the America that it ought to be. But that doesn't mean I suddenly just turn my back on my country. And you don't turn your back on Israel, even though a lot of the people in the leadership and a lot of people that are in there are not bloodline Jews and not believing in a system that's good for the world or good for Israel. You've got your communist Jews, your globalist Jews, and so on and so forth. They're the ones that are kind of in control. But you say the Jew and the Jewish people is this and that. Well, the anti-Semitic statements you hear a lot, that's not proper. It's not fair, and it's definitely against biblical teachings. We are not to abandon Israel, whether we think it's the right Israel or not. Now, that's just my opinion. Now, so we've talked about the 16th Amendment. We've talked about the Federal Reserve. We've talked about what Curtis B. Dahl had to say. Now let's get deeper into the 17th Amendment. In the Article 1 of the United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 3, Article 1, Section 3 of the United States Constitution says, "The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote." We have a bicameral Congress. We have two houses. The Senate is the voice of the states and the rural areas originally, and the House, being based on population, the voice of the people and the cities. We have different ways of looking at the legislative process. We have different eyes. And I was teaching a class in Murrieta, and one of the students, a friend of mine, Todd, brings up something that, and I hadn't heard this in so long, I couldn't even remember the story, but he brought it up, the cup and saucer analogy that the founders used, Roger Sherman used. It's like, when it came to, the Congress, the cup was the House of Representatives, the saucer, which, back then, there were deep saucers, they were like almost like a small bowl, was the Senate. And the hot tea or the hot coffee in the cup was being compared to the House of Representatives, where, the hotter heads prevailed and the hotter heads were, doing their thing, and it was hotly contested on what was going on, because these were the people that represented the states, and they were not as politically savvy, and so on and so forth, than the Senate, being the members of the voice of the states, because these members of the Senate were appointed by the state legislatures, would be the saucer. You pour the hot liquid into the saucer where it cools, and it takes more time, and it's a cooler heads prevail kind of thing. So that is really the idea of us having a bicameral Congress and them being different from each other and allowing the state legislatures to appoint the members of the United States Senate. By them appointing the members of the United States Senate, what it did is it allowed different points of view, different sets of eyes, and allowed for the cooler heads to prevail because they were more politically savvy. In a sense, they were America's version of an aristocracy. In an aristocracy, you have a ruling elite, a ruling class that is born into it or is a part of the big, you know, club or whatever. They've been involved in a while and all sort of stuff. Typically, the powerful and the wealthy. You saw this in Rome. Rome had two houses of their legislature. They had their assembly, which was the people, and by the way, at that time for them was the only house that could actually propose law. And then the Senate, which were the powerful and the wealthy, and that's where also the consuls, which was their version of the executive branch, and their judicial branch also resided. There was no separation of powers. You got also the British Parliament, right? You got the House of Commons and the House of Lords. You got the voice of the people. Then you got the aristocracy in the House of Lords. But we don't have a ruling class per se. There's no nobility. And so we don't have a House of Lords. We have a United States Senate, but it's kind of our version of an aristocracy, because what was going on is originally the push was for a single house, a single chamber legislature, unicameral, one chamber, and the Virginia plan was that chamber would be based on the population. So in other words, the states with the larger populations would dominate that legislature. And the New Jersey plan, smaller state, New Jersey says, we're a smaller state. We're not going to be overwhelmed and controlled and overpowered by the states with larger populations. That's not right. In this country, we need to all have an even voice per state, regardless of population. That way, the rural areas also have a voice. Population centers shouldn't be controlling everything. We know that tyranny comes from population centers. Why would we give them all the power? So what they did is they then, you know, argued back and forth, Virginia plan, New Jersey plan, Virginia plan, New Jersey plan, and Roger Sherman from Connecticut says, well, why can't we have both? Let's have a compromise here. Let's have two houses of Congress. One will be based on the Virginia plan. That'll be the voice of the people. One will be based on the New Jersey plan. That'll be the voice of the states. State legislatures will appoint the legislators. And that way we have our form of aristocracy. These are the people. The people are going to be appointed by the state legislatures. These are going to be people that have some type of experience. They're going to be in that legislature being politically savvy. They're going to be the cooler heads. Cooler heads will prevail. You got your cup and saucer situation. And that became known as the Connecticut Compromise. So you got the Connecticut Compromise, gives us a bicameral Congress, and the second house of the Congress, the U.S. Senate, was different on purpose. They were appointed by the state legislatures, not democratically voted in by the people, in order to make sure that there was balance in our legislature, that you have an additional set of eyes looking at the process that looks at things from a different point of view. 17th Amendment changed that, took away that, eliminated the appointment of the senators by the state legislatures and changed it to a vote by the people. So now the U.S. Senate used to be the voice of the rural areas, but now because they're being democratically voted in, even in the rural states, who's really voting in the senators? The population centers, the cities. What it does, it gives the population centers all the power in the Senate, or at least a large chunk of power. So now let's read the amendment. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators in each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. When vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of each state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election, as the legislature may direct. This amendment shall not be construed as to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as part of the Constitution. In other words, whoever's holding office now, not affected. Now meaning at the time, 1913. But once this thing gets ratified, and once those people are complete with their offices, they must be appointed, or next election, it must be an election by the people, not an appointment by the state legislatures. Democracy. So we have the 16th Amendment that moves us away from being a republic to democracy by taking away the state's oversight over the budget. And then we have the 17th Amendment taking away the republic, a mechanism of the being a republic towards democracy by taking away the state's legislature's oversight over the legislative process, over the ratification of treaties, and over the confirmation of nominations by the President of the United States. Could you imagine how different the nomination confirmation hearings for, say, Supreme Court judges, for example, because that's been in the news a lot lately, how different it would be if those members of the United States Senate were not elected but appointed by the state legislatures as originally intended? Be a whole different conversation. Because first of all, these U.S. senators, their point of view isn't the constituency of the people, it's the states and the union. What's best for the union? After all, the federal government's not supposed to be involved in the lives of the people of the states. Its job is the union. Shouldn't that be the criteria from which the questions are being asked by the members of Senate, rather than this democratic way of looking at things? Our whole premise is off center. Our whole premise is off. And we believe that's okay. We believe that's just the way it is. It's the way it should be, we're taught. And so we don't argue, because we're convinced it's a democracy. And we're convinced there's nothing we can do about it. It is what it is. We're just a small little pawn in this much larger game. We got to the point where our vote don't even feel like it matters. And our whole system is off whack because it's no longer a republic. So that's the Federal Reserve Act, the 16th Amendment, the 17th Amendment. And the lesson here is we need to go back to being a republic. We need to go back to what the Constitution originally was designed to be. When we were following the original intent of the Constitution, the federal government could not do anything without approval of the state legislatures. Their budget, state legislatures paid the tax. Legislative process, the state legislatures through their U.S. senators were approving what bills could get out of Congress. Treaties. President can go out there and negotiate treaties all day. He can sign as many as you want, but they are not effective until the United States Senate ratifies them. And that includes every single international agreement. I know a lot of you are worried about the World Health Organization agreement. You know, unfortunately, our salvation came from the rest of the world saying, hey, we don't want to give away our sovereignty. It wasn't just American sovereignty. It was every country's sovereignty that got into this deal. And the United States proposed, our current Biden administration proposed 13 amendments that would basically strip countries of their sovereignty and put the power and control of what goes on during a quote-unquote pandemic emergency in the hands of the World Health Organization, where they can set up checkpoints, where they can set up camps to send the infected to, and so on and so forth. But many of the countries that are involved here, mostly Africa, rejected it. Rejected 12 of those 13 recommendations, amendments. But here's the thing. We're being told, well, yeah, but they're going to, just give our sovereignty away. Well, the presidency can't do that. Every international agreement has to be a treaty and has to be ratified by the Senate. And they say, well, no, it's a contract. It's a charter. We're just already a part of it, and we can make any change we want. No, if you amend something, it's got to be approved by the Senate constitutionally. So they're violating the Constitution by trying to give who all of this power without a senatorial ratification. Why was it that way? That was the state's way when the states were appointing the senators to make sure something like this wouldn't happen. State legislatures had to approve all of the treaties through the Senate. Ratification. President can negotiate and sign foreign agreements all he wants, but it still has to be approved by the Senate. So, 16th Amendment, 17th Amendment, Federal Reserve, handing away our position as a republic, losing our republic to the idea of a democracy. Well, Doug, republic, democracy, it means the same thing. No, it doesn't. And in fact, in the Federalist Papers, five times in the Federalist Papers, James Madison explained the difference between a democracy and a republic. Why did he feel the need to do that? Because even back then, the forces against the Constitution were trying to convince everybody that democracy and republic are the same thing. No, democracy is a transitional system from a republic to an oligarchy. In other words, what happens when you allow democracy is it transitions your system towards tyranny. Democracies never last. They always destroy themselves and become oligarchies. Oligarchies meaning the few ruled over by the many. I mean, if you get into the Latin of it, the word oligarchy comes from Latin, and what oligarchy in Latin basically means is rule over the many by the few. And that's what systems become if you allow democracy, which means rule by the people, in Greek, to come in. Demos and crassi. Then in the Latin, res publica, republic, that's the public thing. It's the rule of law, natural law. That's what we're supposed to be. All right, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week right here on K-Praise. It's been a pleasure having you. Don't forget, donate. You pay for this show. If I don't get donations, the show doesn't get funded. DouglasDGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com. Share this information. Let everybody know, hey, I listen to the show. It's a great show. K-Praise, KPRZ.com, every Saturday night, 9 o'clock Pacific. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America, my friends. God bless you. We'll see you next time.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.